Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 55, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 621. And we are starting the final block of papers in part two of the book, a pair of papers again. It's like the previous block. And this pair, you kind of have a good hint about what the pair is about by the title of the next paper. But a little bit more precisely, this block is about universal coordination. as you'll see when we start going through the paper on light and life here, we want to really keep that in mind. Remember how we built up to that when we went through the planetary mortal epochs, you know, which culminate in the era of light and life, that you were step by step getting sort of the parts, you might say, in fully in place, you know, uplifted and hence fully activated and manifesting. And once all the parts are in place, then you bring it together into a full coordination that synchronizes with the cosmos in a full way. Then it's just a matter from that point on, once you, once a world enters light and life, for instance, to see to that coordination on that world becoming more and more complete. Just like when you become a finaliter and you take that oath to the Paradise Trinity, to the source of coordination, and then you proceed as a finaliter for who knows how long, you know, until the grand universe is settled in light and life, just achieving more and more and more, greater and greater, more and more extensive coordination, and, until you're coordinated to completeness, at least from a finite perspective. You know, and then you go on and work on it in the absentite. But when you think about that, you know, we've been going through parts one and two, and just noticing that parts, so they're ending up this with having laid out lots and lots of the parts about the whole big picture. You know, starting way on high like we did, and working our way down all the way to inhabited worlds, and so part two is culminating with a description of that issue of the coordination of the universe of universes. You know, after part two, you go in specifically to the history of this planet. Right? So, you know, this parts one and two have been laying out the whole universe of universes in a top-down fashion, and so it's very appropriately ending with the subject of coordination, universal coordination. All right, I think we'll just leave it at that and jump in. Why don't you go ahead and get us started here.
The age of light and life is the final evolutionary attainment of a world of time and space. From the early times of primitive man, such an inhabited world has passed through the successive planetary ages, and the pre and the post, planetary prince ages, the post-Adamic age, the post-magisterial sun age, and the post-bestowal sun age. And then is such a world made ready for the culminating evolutionary attainment, the settled status of light and life, by the ministry of the successive planetary missions of the Trinity Teacher Sons, with their ever-advancing revelations of divine truth and cosmic wisdom. In these endeavors, the teacher's sons enjoy the assistance of the brilliant evening stars, always, and the Melchizedek sometimes, in establishing the final planetary age.
Can we just pick up that last little point? You notice they've given us a little bit more detail relative to talking about the Trinity teacher-son missions there, that the brilliant evening stars are always working with them, and sometimes the Melchizedek's, that whole process. But besides that little factual augmentation from what we know already, so you go, okay, so this is our first paragraph. They're starting us out like that. Why? Now you can, if you reflect a little bit, you see there's a clue there. If you're definitively remembering those planetary mortal epics, and they're going, okay, pre and post planetary prince, post Adamic, post magisterial, post bestowal son, and you're expecting them to just toss in the other one too in that sequence, but they don't. Why don't they say post Trinity teacher son, right in that sequence? Why do they separate it apart? Because of what I was just saying a little bit ago. Right, they're reminding you that those dispensations are very much about getting all of the parts in place. And who is it then that begins the coordination of those parts? What kind of teacher sons?
Trinity.
Teacher sons. Right? They're trying to get you to notice that difference. You've been building up, and finally now, once you have, it's your post-bestowal son, you've got the final part in place, and those agents of coordination, those agents of the Paradise Trinity, literally the offspring of the Paradise Trinity, set to work, with however long it takes, and it varies from world to world. Remember how some worlds, you may have to have many different dispensations of teacher sons. It's all, it's a very relative to the world thing about getting it coordinated. It's, you have this kind of very precise phenomenon of, of those previous dispensations, with the little exception, remember, you may throw in some magisterial sons after the post-bestowal son. But again, those are philosophic uplifters. They're priming the pump for this coordination. Right? They're trying to get things ready to really begin to synchronize the world as a part of the whole, right? Instead of just a fully functioning part, but really getting into definitive relationship with the whole. Right, so, see, that's, if you just, notice that little thing, that's the clue, that should push you to finally put the pieces together. Aha, I get it. That's what they're trying to stress, that the Trinity teacher sons, through their efforts, get the world into its initial state of coordination. And then you go forward from that point, like I said, getting the world coordinated in a more and more complete fashion. That process is not going to be fully complete until the grand universe is settled in light and life, right? Because no part can make the final steps of coordinate completeness until the whole achieves coordinate completeness. But we'll get into some of those details here as we go forward. But But any, you know, and notice one other little detail in there about the Trinity teacher sons with their ever advancing revelations of divine truth and cosmic wisdom. Right? I mean, just the word cosmic about, you know, this, the whole, but truth and wisdom. Right? We're talking about the full philosophic coordination of the world. And those two different ways that you speak about the relationship to the whole, truth on the one hand, wisdom on the other. That's what you want to be really want to keep in the back of your mind all the time as you're going through this paper. How is this informing me about this process of coordination, or how is it informing me about that kind of a goal that a planet can, you know, long before Trinity Teacher Sons can sort of set its sights on, that is, it does the initial details of the previous of the prior dispensations to kind of have that in mind, that you're moving towards that goal of a phenomenon that's going to be coordinatable. You know, and then it will be fostered into that coordination to actualize that potential. You can think about, our world with a bestowal sun. You kind of have it very up front that when a creator sun is a bestowal sun, he'll say, he who has seen me has seen the Father. He who has seen me has seen the initiator, the primer of the pump, the potentializer. Right? And you see it in this context. You've got that final cherry on the top of the potentializing of coordinate ability. Now, and then you begin to actualize that potential. All right, so that's you want to have that very definitive in mind when you think about the age of light and life, because initially it's just your spiritual consciousness that's going to feel an affinity towards this phrase, light and life, and you're going to be thinking in terms of just some sort of sublime spiritual phenomenon. Now, we're talking cosmic, not merely spiritual. Let's keep going here.
This era of light and life, inaugurated by the teacher sons at the conclusion of their final planetary mission, continues indefinitely on the inhabited worlds. Each advancing stage of settled status may be segregated by the judicial actions of the magisterial sons into a succession of dispensations, but all such judicial actions are purely technical, in no way modifying the course of planetary events.
Okay, so you see that in Light and Life, you have something a little bit similar to the way they talked about things with post-Trinity teacher son age or ages. Settled status may be segregated. Okay, there's a lot of complexity. Before Light and Life, some additional teacher sons might come into play on the world. That doesn't necessarily mean there's a dispensational boundary. It might. It might not. You have a similar thing here. It's very definitive. If you have a magisterial son come, okay, that's a new dispensation. Period. But you've got this subtlety of, because you're trying to do a very subtle thing of synchronizing with the whole. And so it requires lots of flexibility from world to world. So that's why they have those qualifiers in both cases about this issue of whether or not you actually have a magisterial son on a judicial action closing a dispensation and inaugurating a new one. Now, you notice here, it says in no way modifying the course of planetary events. So you get the impression there, the fact that they've made a point of saying that, that the dispensations that you might, multiple dispensations that you might have in during light and life, are probably not as sweeping a transformation of the sort of the energy environment, the sort of the nature of the whole world phenomenon, like we talked about, as it was when you were like going from the magisterial sun age to the bestowal sun age. You know, we talked about how there was just sort of a very definitive change in the whole environment that all the phenomena were immersed in, functioning within. The context of the doings of that world definitively changes from one dispensation to the next. But here, you know, they seem to be indicating you basically have everything all up in play. So, you know, there's no sort of huge new thing that can be added. Like I said, you've got all the parts. So you're not going to be adding some whole new part, you know, that wasn't there before. So that's, you know, that seems to be what is behind that statement.
Could you refer to that as a bureaucratic issue?
Well, it's going to be an issue of, you know, do we want to close a dispensation on this planet and have a large number of people that haven't gone on individually from this planet fed into the ascension scheme in the local universe? You've got that whole logistics of who is in the ascension scheme in the local universe at any given time. I mean, that's a whole vast logistics thing of, you know, there's not going to be any coincidence about who happens to be in the pipeline at any given time and how they interact because they happen to be in the pipeline together, right? So there's a whole elaborate coordination of that whole phenomenon, you know, and you've got this as the bottom end of it. It's like, okay, it's time to feed a block from this world up into the chain, and so they do, you know, and, you know, we can't even imagine why this might be, right? But that would be the, you know, it's you know, just as they use those special resurrections for, you know, we want this handful of people, you know, on the mansion worlds right now or whatever. You know, they're doing it with a full dispensational resurrection the same way. We want this world to feed some into the system right now. You know, and, you know, as we'll talk about later, you know, if the world is well into light and life, you know, you're not feeding these people into the mansion worlds. You're feeding them in, you know, up the line a ways. You know, maybe right directly into the local universe headquarters. Yeah, right. Yeah. So anyway, so it's all that complication of
skipping constellation.
You know, skipping the constellation, for instance. You know, but then of course they come back as teachers. You know, maybe that's a big point that you need those another block that come back as teachers for certain beings that are down in the mansion worlds from some other world, and right, it's all inscrutably complicated. All right, let's see. What else do we have there? You notice it continues indefinitely because, right, no one knows when the grand universe is going to be settled in light and life, and it just goes on and on and on and on, these ever more settled stages of light and life. Okay.
Only those planets which attain existence in the main circuits of the super universes are assured...
Universe.
Yeah. Are assured of continuous survival. But as far as we know, these worlds, settled in light and life, are destined to go on throughout the eternal ages of all future time.
So besides just, you know, thinking about inhabited worlds, you know, notice the sort of the corollary going on there. Only those planets which attain existence in the main circuits of the super universe are assured of continuous survival. You know, remember how we've often wondered about, you know, what becomes of all the planets in the universe of universes that aren't inhabited planets? Right. Like, for instance, what becomes of Jupiter? You know, how does, and, you know, there's, no one knows, I'm sure, you know, in terms of finite beings on high. fully how that all plays out, but at some point, based upon the central universe, there aren't uninhabited just spare worlds, you know, like some, you know, oddball gas giant, you know, floating around in the central universe or something like that. I mean, you know, so apparently at some point all this stuff, something is done with all this sort of extraneous material, you know, when it no longer serves some purpose of physical stabilizing of inhabited solar systems or, you know, who knows what. But, you know, stars that aren't involved in an inhabited world and all these planets, all the, you know, all the, you know, cometary, you know, debris and meteoric debris and whatnot. I mean, all that stuff has to be somehow dealt with, you know, some point down in the future.
So, the main circuits, you know, trying to envision that, you know, I mean, thinking of, obviously there's some universes that are already achieved life and light. They talk about it,
right?
You know, some
maybe
not major sectors, whatever. But so there's when you look towards the center of the Milky Way or whatever, toward looking towards the center of our super universe. Are do you think what happens is that as you advance towards light and life, that and as your whole you know system does and everything else, that eventually you know you swing into some sort of part of space that is not quite as evolutionary or as much more settled and actually move, the planet actually moves into some other part of space?
The first thing you would want to think of about the quote-unquote circuits there is not a literal space path circuit, but just the energy circuits. I'll get to that. I'll answer your question too, but initially think of it as being really definitively encircuited in all of the energy doings at the super universe level. And what comes with that would be, like I was just referring, right now you have a lot of stabilization of things and whatnot that is done via... you know, astronomic systems and things. Like right now, Jupiter's very important for the stability of our solar system and stuff, okay? But eventually, those kind of quote-unquote natural ways of things being stabilized and whatnot, eventually all that is replaced by artificial engagement of everything. And you don't need any help from Jupiter anymore because the power beings are just fully, you know, in control of this phenomenon.
You're not even using gravity, right? Well, maybe you are.
Right, I mean, they're working with gravity, but I mean, it's just, see, you know, they're more and more, it's a definitive controlled by beings, you know, and entities, the non-personal power beings, you know, domain. And then, see, from that, that means eventually everything is going to be moving into actual spatial circuits of some final nature. But see, I'm just trying to point out, see, there's an evolution towards that. You know, you wouldn't just immediately grab a hold of it and shove it clear over here, you know, and something like that. You know, because it's part of this whole complicated system.
But, you know, I mean... It says on indefinitely, you know, and our sun probably, you know, may not can blaze on indefinitely.
Yes, it will, because they'll encircuit it, and it'll be an eternal object.
Yeah, but the solar system, as you say, may change. All the other planets that don't have life may not exist.
Right, right.
So
the whole system
has, it would seem to me, sort of reconfigures itself to some degree.
Right, and you're going, well, what do they do with all the extreme, I mean, do they combine all the other planets and stuff into the sun? What do they do with all this stuff? I mean,
storage.
I mean, that would be like a major alteration. But of course, you know, remember, you've got power beings that, you know, can actually keep Nebadon together as it goes around the Milky Way. Okay, so a single star is a minor issue. You know, so maybe they collect everything together, and you know, and they're taking such definitive control of that star, making it an eternal object. That it's not like well, you toss in Jupiter, it's going to completely destabilize the sun and it's going to make it uninhabitable on Earth and stuff. Well, not if they're just completely in control of the phenomenon.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, if you just tossed it in there, right? Yeah, it'd be a problem. But
well,
I don't know.
In time, a long time, that the grand universe will enter, you know, sort of be functioning like the central universe does.
Yeah.
Only, you know, and how it's designed may be something we can't.
Right, we don't know how it's going to be designed, yeah.
But the next, probably won't be the planets as far as the other,
right.
Like the other one.
Yeah.
But to me, it seems like this would be the stopping place for the people coming from the outer universes. Coming in, they go through this verse, and
right.
Then they go.
Right.
And however this ends up being designed is kind of.
Right. Yeah. You know, and you know, fundamentally, the final design of the seven super universes that's going to be relevant to what goes on after that is an absinite geometry.
Oh, gosh, I
right?
thought of that.
Yeah. Remember, you know, fundamentally, the central universe is not, you know, that finite projection that they give us. It isn't literally, I mean, you won't relate to it in a finite geometry sense when you're there as these flattened string of pearls. I mean, you'll relate it in some sort of a transcendent way. You know, we're literally, when the grand universe is settled in light and life, everything transcends all finite geometry. You know, and you know, none of us even remotely know what that means exactly, right? But you know, it will have some sort of a crystallized structure in an absinite geometry. You know, and so, you know, this whole bit of when we talk about moving things, we're thinking moving in finite geometry, but when you transcend finite geometry, all distances disappear. All finite distances are transcended.
Hard to understand.
You know, I mean, there is no difference between an inch and a mile from an absinite perspective, right? They're both of no length at all. Right, there are no finite angles or any. See, all finite geometry, angular and you know, and translational, is all transcended.
Can't relate.
And of course, that doesn't make any sense, you know, in any direct way to us. But that's you know, that's going to happen. You know, that's why if you transcend the if you're fully transcendent of the finite geometry, you know, it takes you the same length of time to go an inch as it does to go a mile, because they're both of zero length. Doesn't
well,
take you any time.
Is it different planet? It gets let's say it's a million years or something. And by that time, still all the other planets are still out there. I mean, they haven't, you know, disappeared in any way. But we can be in a state of light and life and still be in, you know, in our solar system, so to speak. In other words,
mm-hmm.
existing.
Yeah, 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 they're going to, you know, get to that about, you know, yeah, how each planet has a relative independence like that. Okay, let's see. Did we get everything? Okay, yeah, we're just talking about this whole, yeah, the main circuits. You know, and see, and they're just stressing, you know, when you've got actual worlds settled in light and life, obviously you can think beyond some sort of finite, continuous survival, quote unquote. I mean, you know, they're actually part of eternity. Right, in some way. Okay.
There are seven stages in the unfoldment of the era of light and life on the evolutionary world. And in this connection, it should be noted that the worlds of the spirit-fused mortals evolve along lines of identical with those of the adjuster fusion series. These seven stages of light and life are 1. The first or planetary stage, 2. The second or system stage, 3. The third or constellation stage, 4. The fourth or local universe stage, 5. The fifth or minor sector stage, 6. The sixth or major sector stage, 7. The seventh or universal super universe stage.
You read that next paragraph too.
At the conclusion of this narrative, these stages of advancing development are described as they relate to the universe organization. But the planetary values of any stage may be attained by any world quite independent of the development of other worlds or of the superplanetary levels of universe administration.
Okay, so if you might remember, if you're familiar with the paper, you've got two different issues that they deal with in this paper. There's the big picture, that, like they say here, that they'll deal with second, of having a whole local system settled in light and life, and then a whole constellation, and then a whole local universe. Okay, so that big picture thing, like they're saying there in that final paragraph, but an individual world can continue to move forward independent of whether or not all the other worlds in its system are settled in light and life. It can move to stage two here, right, the second or system stage. Right? So it's effectively, that one world is effectively in a system stage of light and life, even though literally the system isn't settled in light and life yet. Right? I mean, you may not even have all of the worlds in the system yet. Right? But the worlds that were created first in that system, are moving on. Right? They've been around for a very, very long time, perhaps.
We may have some in our system.
Yeah, who knows? That first batch, we're in batch three, right? So that first batch, they've you'd think they would have gone down the path quite a ways. Anyway, so that's what they're getting at. You have a literal system settled in light and life, and then but locally you can have effectively. So you can have a world that's pushing into a stage of light and life, that has shades of the whole super universe being settled in light and life. But, the super universe isn't even remotely close to that, right? But this world is, way ahead of time. It will definitely be ready for that day in the far future when the super universe settles in light and life. So you have these foretastes of the feast to come, see? And again, it reminds you of how nonlinear fundamentally the evolution of the supreme is, right? When you see this sort of stuff, right? It's not like everything is just all in lockstep being pushed along a line. It's a very complex thing to complete wholeness, right? When we think about completing partness, right, that's linear, right? But that's not happening here, right? So it has this very complicated nature to it, that the only way that you can get a local universe settled in light and life is if some of the worlds have been effectively at that level, for billions and billions and billions and billions of years, right? Okay, so that's the way it works. They're seeds. They're obviously priming the pump in some way, right? For it to happen, for the whole local universe or whatever chunk you're talking about. All the different you see. You notice the beauty of how this all works together. You're going, it's not surprising there's seven stages of light and life. And you go, planet, system, constellation, local, universe, minor sector, major sector, super universe. It works out to be seven. Right? I mean, all this is this amazingly interrelated phenomenon, where everything coordinates together. Okay. All right, let's see. What else do we have there? Just notice that they're not qualifying it. The planetary values of any stage may be attained by any world, quite independent. And so, it reminds you of, just one other thought there, how primitive was this planet 2,000 years ago? And did that prevent Jesus from reaching for a circular? No, see, so that's the same phenomenon, on a smaller scale. Right? I mean, remember that, you are fundamentally not limited by the environment, because if nothing else, there's an absolute dimension to your personality. right? So you can overcome those environmental issues. A world can get into the fifth stage even though its environment is far from it. Yeah, yeah.
Just a question, sort of a theoretical question. In some of the advanced stages, say the fifth or sixth stage of light and life, are these planets, are the inhabitants of these advanced planets still terrestrially bound, or maybe technologically they can?
Again, we've talked about that. For those of you in the webinar, if you weren't picking up that, the issue of, you know, you have a world that's way settled in light and life, and you're wondering, are they still just basically hanging out on the planet, or are they part of some galactic federation of spacefarers? Basically, no. Right? I mean, there's no motivation for you to be creating this incredible technology to be a spacefaring people, as a blob of protoplasm, because you know you're going to be dead in short order and you're going to be traveling all over. I mean, yeah. So, right, the whole science fiction thing that we have of, is a result of the fact that we're isolated. We desire to go to the universe because the universe apparently, hasn't come to us. Now, it actually is here, right? But if we hadn't had the rebellion and the fall, right, everyone, it would be apparent, that the universe had come to us. There's no need to, expend some great effort to try to go to it.
Kind of a waste of
it. It's complete waste, right? It comes to you, right? The motivations on a normal world are very different. All right. Okay. So I think we got everything there. Let's move into the first section here. So, having set that stage, now we start to get some details. And the first thing they want to address is that most burning fact in our minds right now. What about my death? You'll notice that not only do they start with that low-hanging fruit in our minds, mortality, but they immediately address our fears relative to mortality. Right? And so you can see there's an ulterior motive here. It's not just giving us details about light and life. It's they're using the opportunity to address that big issue that looms large in everyone's mind here.
The exit.
Yeah. Okay.
The Morontia Temple. The presence of a Morontia Temple at the capital of an inhabited world is the certificate of the admission of such a sphere to the settled ages of light and life. Before the teacher's sons leave a world at the conclusion of their terminal mission, they inaugurate this final epoch of evolutionary attainment. They preside on that day when the holy temple comes down upon earth. This event, signalizing the dawn of the era of light and life, is always honored by the personal presence of the paradise bestowal son of that planet, who comes to witness this great day. There in this temple, the unparalleled beauty, this bestowal son of paradise proclaims the longtime planetary prince as the new planetary sovereign and invests such a faithful Lanonadec son with new powers and extended authority over planetary affairs. The system sovereign is also present and speaks in confirmation of these pronouncements.
Okay, so all the mucky mucks show up on the planet. In our case, it will be a very much a big mucky muck. our creator son will be here on that day. And so notice how they you know, how they bring this out. You know, they, you know, the quote unquote thing in there is basically, you know, just giving you the essence of what's there in the book of Revelation. Obviously, quote unquote, holy temple comes down upon earth. You know, all that stuff about, you know, a new heaven, new earth, new Jerusalem, all, you know, in that mode when, you know, in the book of Revelation is talking about those sorts of things. But, you know, they're pointing out that, you know, you have this sort of, you know, as they called it, a certificate. And where was that? Somewhere there. Yeah, right there in that very first sentence. You know, the certificate of the admission. Right. You have this literal object that marks, you know, the official beginning of light and life. It isn't just some sort of abstract thing, you know, that you tell everyone, now it's different. You know, everyone could tell, okay, because literally there's this going to be this Maranatha temple on the planet. Okay, something that's very different. Heaven is literally going to be brought down to earth. You're going to have not just material structures on this planet, but an actual Maranatha structure.
So it's going to be
Maranatha. On the planet, right? Made out of Maranatha material. Okay.
That'll get people's attention.
It won't be invisible.
Right, and then there's all those issues, right, that, you know, about...
unparalleled beauty.
But remember, by this point, the beings can see all the lower... Right, so right, it'll be visible. You know, you can see the lower beings and stuff with the help of genetic, you know, uplifting and, you know, and genetic engineering, plus the master physical controllers are doing things.
The midwares would be visible to us,
right? So you know when you bring the midware culture and the human culture together on a world, right? They can see each other. Obviously, it'd be pretty hard to bring the cultures together if you couldn't see each other. Okay. So, all right. So they're just pointing out there's definitely, you know, some validity to those seemingly fanciful thoughts in the Book of Revelation. You know, here it is. Given a measure of literal validity at the dawning of the age of light and life on a world. Let's see. And, okay, so you've got to, you know, the Paradise Bestowal Son is there to officiate, and you get the Planetary Prince bumped up to Planetary Sovereign. You know, but now it's in the result of a long evolutionary validity, not that fiat thing that Caligastia wanted done to him 200,000 years ago, right? Ta-da, you're Planetary Sovereign, God of Urantia. Now it's finally appropriate. The fullness of time is in place, so there's no rebellion to making that transition to Planetary Sovereign and having all that additional authority that they were, you know, yearning for 200,000 years ago. You know, and even the Planetary Sovereign comes down. Okay, so very big to do. You can imagine what a grand ceremony that's going to be on this planet when that occurs. There'll be lots of party hats and hoopla. So kind of a fun thing to think about, exactly how that'll play out. You know, I mean, how many people will be, like, right there local, you know? And, you know, how will you make sure that everyone on the planet can observe it, you know? And there'll be some sort of communication thing happening so everyone can participate in a grand fashion. Okay, what else do they give us here?
A Maranatha temple has three parts. Centermost is the sanctuary of the Paradise Bestowal Son. On the right is the seat of the former Planetary Prince, now Planetary Sovereign, and when present in the temple, this Lanadec Sun is visible to the more spiritual individuals of the realm. On the left is the seat of the acting chief of Finaliters attached to the planet.
Okay, so... that last little bit, you know, that is reminding you of, you know, what's really in play now in a world of subtle enlightened life. Very much the finaliters, they aren't just prepping. There's finaliters here right now, way in advanced preparation. But now it's, things are fully up and going in terms of looking to the future. This world, is now going to be coordinated into the whole. That's what the finaliters are there for, with that oath to the whole, to the Paradise Trinity. That's why they're there, right? To be definitively overseeing that. So again, you see, what I've been emphasizing about what's going on when you're entering light and life. It's about this coordinate phenomenon. In our case, again, when you think about it being Michael's world, quote unquote, right? I mean, there it is made literal. Center most is the sanctuary of the Paradise Bestowal Son. In our case, it's none other than, right, our Master Son. So, he's forever going to be very literalized, in his identification to this world. It's not just a figurehead thing going forward in the future.
But he wouldn't hang out here. I mean, he's still going to be.
Well, who knows, right? I mean, that once the local universe is settled in light and life, they tell you that, Master Sons are often out of the local universe and stuff. But still, he's out and about a lot. But he's got a definite anchor point. Right? It's not going to be like the temple of the unseen father somewhere, where it's always empty, right? He would be here often, I'm sure, going forward.
Wow. I'm just trying to picture this temple. It's apparently meant to be viewed from the outside from one.
Apparently, the fact that you've got the left-right thing happening here.
It's not in the round.
Apparently.
Are they talking about left and right from the centermost point?
Again, I don't know. I mean, you could argue that there's still some validity to left and right, even if it is in the round. I don't know. They throw in that, to indicate at least there's, for some circumstances anyway, there's a sidedness to what's going on. There's so little information, you can only speculate. So take it for what it is. Notice they've got this bit about, this Lenonidex son is visible to the more spiritual individuals of the realm. And like we were saying a minute ago, that the mortals in a world in light and life, they've been augmented so that spirit energy in the external world, has some newfound literalness to it. It's never going to be like when you actually are a Marantia, being, and you can, it's literally kind of out there as buildings and stuff, spirit blocks and things, right? But you can see they're trying to point, when they say spiritual individuals, that doesn't mean, I have these airy-fairy feelings. We're not talking about that, right? We're talking about beings that have a more direct relationship to that other substance in the external world. And the mortals on these worlds have been augmented so that they can have some initial tangibility of relationship to the other substance. So that you can see the angels and things like that, right?
But not all. Apparently.
Right. I mean, there's always going to be variation, but eventually, it moves down. They'll talk about later about how, you don't have everyone on these planets all in a tight little group. There's still a spectrum of individuals on these worlds.
Okay. finaliters wouldn't be visible.
Yeah, the finaliters, right, yeah, that, you know, remember how they talk about that's a very special thing to visualize the finaliters on, you know, when you're going through the mansion worlds. Yeah, so it's a possibility, you know, they can be visualized, but they're not going to be just visible. Right. You know, whereas, you know, Adam and Eve can see all the lower spiritual beings. No one's visualizing them. They can just see them. And, you know, so. But apparently from the way they describe it, you know, it requires some help from the master physical controllers for the mortals to be able to see things. So there's a bit of visualization going on. They're kind of, functioning in some energetic intermediary fashion to facilitate your ability to, you know, to see the lower beings. But, you know, they don't explain the details. Okay, what else they say here?
Although the planetary temples have been spoken of as coming down from heaven, in reality, no actual material is transported from the system headquarters.
I was going to ask that.
The architecture of each is worked out in miniature on the system capital, and the Morontia power supervisors subsequently bring these approved plans to the planet. Here, in association with the master physical controllers, they proceed to build the Morontia temple according to specifications.
Okay, so remember how we've talked indirectly about this issue, the mystery of your soul, right, as a Morontia construct. But there's no Morontia power supervisors here, right? Right, that's, you know, one of the mysteries of Ascendington. Right? One of the secrets of Ascendington. I mean, how can you have a Morontia structure when there's no Morontia power supervisors? Right? But here, you're going to build this Morontia building. Okay, so you've got to have the Morontia power supervisors here, along with the master physical controllers, to make Morontia atoms
stuff
and Morontia molecules and Morontia blocks. Right? Right. So, you know, and I'm sure it's a fascinating thing because, you know, it's probably not built in a, it's probably built, quote unquote, in a very organic way. You know, they just sort of have a presence in that space and it just begins to, you know, crystallize in their presence, you know, and it's probably very fascinating to watch it happen as it sort of just grows into existence before your eyes.
The plans, yeah, are probably.
Yeah, they're on scrolls with a wax seal on them. And the plans would be in their head. But you notice that it isn't all just done, you know they actually build a miniature. And you're going, well, okay, don't they have this figured out? You know, why would it need to be worked out in miniature in the system capital? Well, every Morontia temple is different, see, obviously. You know, think between the lines of what that implies. Right? There's something very, very organically synchronized with the specific world about each Morontia temple. They're not just cookie cutter, all the same.
Right? But also, if there's a model, they can take them on tour around the planet.
You know, the model, it probably ends up in one of those display areas. You know, remember how they talk about it? You've got all those things about a sort of the essence of a particular planet, you know, is on display up there. So, all right. So anyway, yeah. So finally, you're going to have Morontia power supervisors here on the planet, you know, doing full-on Morontia stuff. Now, remember, we wondered about exactly what had to be in place, especially on this planet, for Michael's sake, right? You know, during his, you know, because basically they brought the Morontia life to him here. So, you know, we may be an exception in terms of having some more definitive Morontia stuff that's happened here prior to Morontia temple time. Okay? Because they had to, you know, he couldn't go to the mansion worlds. They had to bring the mansion worlds to him.
What are the dwellings of the what do they call
What are you getting at? Give a clue.
It's the
Finalers, what do you think?
No, no.
Not Finalers, the
Dwellings for the Midwares?
No. Yeah. They're not Maranchan, are they?
We don't know what kind of structures the Midwares have that are not material.
Yeah.
But you know the secondary Midwares are going to have some material structures too, because they take care of material things. But we just don't know. We don't know anything about that. Like we said, there probably are some spirit substance structures on this planet. We just don't know how much there is in terms of non-material structures. I mean, maybe there are some Maranchan structures. Maybe they don't talk about that. Maybe the Maranchan power supervisors, come over the course of the dispensations, and maybe there is some things that have to be here in place before the Maranchan temple. But in terms of what they reveal to us, this appears to be at least the biggie thing, that when the Maranchan power supervisors are actually here doing stuff, finally. And then again, who knows how much stuff they do on these worlds subsequent to the Maranchan temple. Right? There may be all, by the time a world is seven stage light and life, I mean, who knows what's on these planets? I mean, because basically, remember, you're getting these worlds so that they're like an architectural sphere. When all is said and done. So there's going to be all kinds of Maranchan and spirit structures, one would assume, on a world.
Sure.
Okay, but, they obviously weren't allowed to talk about all that. Okay.
The average Maranchan temple seats about 300,000 spectators. These edifices are not used for worship, play, or for receiving broadcasts. They are devoted to the special ceremonies of the planet, such as communications with system sovereign or with the Most Highs, special visualization ceremonies designed to reveal the personality, presence of spirit beings, and silent cosmic contemplation. The schools of cosmic philosophy here conduct their graduation exercises, and here also do the mortals of the realm receive planetary recognition for achievements of high social service and for other outstanding attainments.
Yeah, so here again you see very directly, remember when you get a world of light and life, very much everything is coordinated together. Philosophy, is the point phenomenon, right, of what's going on in the world. You see them, even pointing out, they're not used for worship, okay, but they're used for silent cosmic contemplation, philosophic reflection. So, again, everything is very much oriented, transcendent of our initial perspective of, boy, I'd love to be able to get up to the point where, I have a more definitive spiritual life, right? I mean, you're way past that, right? And your material and spiritual lives have been coordinated together into a philosophic life, and that's fundamentally the life you live, you don't have... the way we think of it, scientists and religionists, right? Everyone's a philosopher. Now, there might be an orientation towards one of the two substances, towards spirit substance or material substance, but everyone is approaching those things from the top down. You're a personal living philosophy in your inner life, and you manifest that very overtly, directly in your outer life, as philosophers. The whole society is only possible for philosophic lives like that, and it's all predicated on that fact. And so, you know, you are just, you have schools of cosmic philosophy, right? See, you know, that's the fundamental phenomenon in play. You'll see them bring that up over and over again. Try to get us to, you know, the fifth epical revelation is the first attempt on this planet to awaken us to that greater goal. You know, I mean, prior to this, they knew that was beyond our imagination. Right? We're trying to just imagine being religious, a handful of us. Right? You know, but for those who have begun to achieve some measure of that, they're making sure that you're not, I'm all content now and I've done it all. Right? They're trying to throw back the horizon again and recognize that that's the ultimate goal that you're heading towards is not a spiritualization of the part, right? But a coordination of that part into the whole. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did you see my hand up here? Good eye. What interests me is because, you know, I was thinking about the temple and everything. You don't think of a temple as maybe three times the size of the Rose Bowl.
Yeah.
It's pretty big. That's got to be a... No wonder they got to take them a while to put it together. And it's going to seat them so... You know, they're not sitting on Morancha substance, I wouldn't think.
Well, again, we don't know exactly how to think about it. We had the same, you know, this same confusion. Remember on the Mansion Worlds, right? You know, this is one thing that we can't sort out exactly. What is the relationship to Morancha substance? You know, we they're talking about, you know, you're a Morancha being and you're drinking material water, right? See, it's the same issue. It's all this same issue that I can't answer. I mean, exactly how this works, but there's obviously some relationship. You know it theoretically because it's why they call it Morancha, that which is akin to matter. There's obviously the potential for matter to be related.
Well, and they have material things in the Morancha worlds.
Right.
The other could be just as...
Right. Some way that we don't currently comprehend.
But human beings are taking up this, you know, a multiple of them on the head of a pin, so to speak.
Right.
In other words, they're taking up the same space. So it's got to be pretty big.
Right. Again, yeah. See, all that is... You know, it's just like spirit substance is real, you know. It occupies a certain volume, right, a finite space. Same way with Morancha substance, right? And, you know, the temple is only so big. It can't fit 500,000, right? Right, so, you know, it's all just as literally spatial as we currently think of it. It's just that you'll have a more profound understanding of the different ways that space can be involved with substance. Currently, we have a very limited perspective on this. See? You know, we often analogize it by saying, like the midwayers are close to us, you know, in a third dimension where, you know, we take our three and we imagine it's just two, you know, but so they're not close to us in the normal sense that we think of close, you know, in that plane, but, you know, they're just a little bit above us, right? We use that analogy. You see, you know, that's the only way we can try to somehow analogize this little bit different relationship to space than we currently can comprehend. You know, Morancha substance and spirit substance have this transcendent relationship to space that you can only analogize by using one of our three dimensions, you know, to substitute for that to indicate that differential, you know, that distance. And a secondary midwayer is close in that additional way, and a primary midwayer is not as close, you know, et cetera. And so that... You know, this will all make sense to us, you know, then exactly.
An angel even more so.
Right, right, an angel even more, you know, a seraphim even more so. The lesser angels, you know, are basically like a secondary midwayer, you know, and are just really, really close to us. in nature. You'll see they refer to them here coming up in a little ways. Let's see here. Okay, so there's all this mystery yet of exactly how you think about this spatially and interactively. You know, just what kind of an interaction do I have with Morontia substance when I'm a mortal on one of these worlds? Again, I can't answer those questions. Okay, but you notice they do visualization ceremonies like they do, like I was mentioning a minute ago, when you're going through the mansion world. So, maybe they do visualize the finaliters, occasionally, just like they do for us when we're going through the mansion worlds. Maybe just, when they say cosmic philosophy, they're just trying to stress that we're talking very much top-down philosophy, not human philosophy, bottom-up philosophy. Okay, well, they'll talk more about all this recognizing achievements and stuff in a little bit, so I think we can just move on here.
Such a Morontia temple also serves as the place for assembly for witnessing the translation of living mortals to the Morontia existence. It is because the translation temple is composed of Morontia material that is not destroyed by the blazing glory of the consuming fire, which so completely obliterates the physical bodies of these mortals, those mortals, who therein experience final fusion with their divine adjusters. In a large world, these departure flares are almost continuous, as the number of translations increase. Subsidiary Morontia life shrines are provided in different areas of the planet. Not long since I sojourned on a world in the north or far north, wherein 25 Morontia shrines were functioning.
Yeah, where on 25 Morontia shrines were functioning. So, so right there, you can see there's additional Morontia structures that are being built. But besides these issues with the temple-like things, we don't know how many other Morontia structures are built. We often refer to this, these comments about the Morontia temples. And so this is the first one. You get the other element here in the next section. So in terms of, the high-energy event that is fusion, if it was a material temple, it'd be vaporized. Right. So the only way that it can withstand this is that it's made out of Morontia substance, so that when this is how you know. I mean, a 300,000 spectator temple is a pretty good sized building. Okay, so that's why you can say that if something special wasn't done with someone when they fuse, like say Elijah, right? He would have vaporized, everything around him. If someone were to fuse in the middle of New York City, they'd vaporize the entire city.
The entire city?
Yeah, it just vaporized the whole thing.
People right in the area.
No, it would vaporize the city. It's much more than a nuclear weapon, right? Yeah, it's a massive amount of energy.
Crazy amount of energy.
Right. Okay. You have to recognize this about these fusion events, right? You're unraveling a whole body, right? There's a lot of energy there stored up. Unraveling it to ultimatons.
To ultimatons, yeah.
Right?
That's why it's crazy.
So, but that doesn't make sense, because the people sitting in the stands would, even if it's that big a thing, witnessing this would be vaporized.
I told you there's more to the story. That's in the next section.
Oh.
It does make sense. You just got to keep reading. As I said, this is the first element. We're worried about the building. We're worried about the spectators next. Okay, but first, the building. So here you're reminded of one of the reasons why it's a Morontia temple. Because you want to do these fusion send-offs there. right? And so it needs to be made out of Marantia substance.
And apparently they're almost continuous.
Yeah.
So before the temple's there, and people are...
Yeah, well, that's in the end of the section here. That's coming up. Just hold on. We'll get there. Right, right. So obviously...
accidental fusions of people we know.
Right.
Spontaneous combustion.
Right. It has nothing to do with quote-unquote spontaneous combustion, you know.
If you take an asteroid, it hit the planet.
Right, right. If it happened, you know, you'd be trying to figure out if a comet impacted the planet or something, right? Okay.
So chariots of fire.
Right.
Under sun.
Yep.
Yeah, Dennis was wondering in that last sentence what they might be referring to by far north.
Okay, yeah. So, remember it's called Norlaishadech for the same reason. That's, you know, the Nor is north. All right. Occasionally they remind you that you can speak of the orientation of things in a super universe relative to how the directions along the big ellipse of their path around the central universe. Right. Remember, right now the super universe is coming around the southern thing and swinging into heading due north for a while. Right, our super universe is, right? Seventh super universe, right? So, right, they're just, in that orientation, right, our local universe, is, there's going to be some of those constellations in our local universe that are more in that northerly direction, in the direction of where our super universe is going to be going, right? And here you're, they're just speaking of, a world in the far north of the local universe. Right? Now, the fact that the constellation in Norlaishadech is obviously in the north, this is probably even more north, see? That's why they say far north, even more northerly in the local universe than our constellation is. Okay, so that's what they're referring to. And so, if it's gone to 25 Marantia shrines, it's obviously well into light and life. You've got a, as you'll see, you're not having everyone fusing when a world gets into light and life. So this would indicate it's way down the path, in light and life. Okay, and it's just, you want to, notice the definitiveness. Destroyed, consuming, completely obliterates, right? I mean, they're saying it like that so you don't get off on some silly tangent. Think, oh, is it like that, that spontaneous combustion thing? No, absolutely not, okay? It's utterly nothing to do with such trivialities, okay? We're talking about completely obliterates, not one atom left together. Everything unraveled into automatons. Right? Because remember, the thought adjuster is not just pure spirit, it's pure energy. Right? You're bringing this physical body into intimate association with a fragment of pure energy. It unravels it. Right? I mean... pure energy is another name for what? From our finite perspective, the force charge of space. Pre-ultimatonic, right? It's being exposed to an influence that, it can't unravel ultimatons, but it's gonna just completely unravel it into ultimatons.
Takes it right to that.
Right. Takes it right to the foundation of the physical. Right. So it's not some triviality like nuclear processes. Okay, a nuclear process is trivial relative to what we're talking about here.
You think that their drop of water energy comparison is more like how we should appreciate scaling that drop all the way to a body size?
Now, obviously you're not, it's not going to be in the sense of like E equals mc squared either, because you're not doing a electronic level process, right. You're doing something more fundamental than that, but there's going to be some measure of energy release like that. You can't just magically take it from fully structured like my body is right now, to automatons without anything in between, right? There's going to be some in-betweenness to that process, and the degree to which there's in-betweenness, there is going to be very definitive energy release. Okay? Okay. All right, so just, you know, I want to try to stress this because I know there's been lots and lots of confusion over the years. I mean, you got to just notice what they're saying here.
Think of the size of this 300,000. It's big.
Yeah.
But when you consider the number of people on our planet, I don't know, what is it right now, 5 or 6 billion?
Yeah.
If a person only went to it once in his lifetime, that would just about utilize all the capacity.
Now, we're going to read a little bit more about it. You'll see, you know, that the whole point is not to have a large crowd observing, you know, a fusion. The idea is not to have, you know, the kind of gathering like you have in the huge stadium on Gerasim, right? You know, you already see shades of that. The schools of cosmic philosophy here conduct their graduation exercises. You know, you have a relatively small class, right? So it's not a venue for the masses, right? It's a special venue, right? I mean, I'm sure you only have the thing fully seated, you know, for big things like they're talking about. If you've got a communications with the system sovereign or with the Most High, okay, maybe the stands are filled.
Michael arrives, I'm sure.
Or whatnot. Yeah.
Just think more about what would be the optimum level of humanity on our planet.
Oh yeah. I mean, who knows, yeah, about that. For those in the webinar, he's wondering how this might relate to the optimum level number of the population of the planet. Does this speak to that? Probably not at all. But the other thing to keep in mind is, remember how they gave you a hint about that? You've got all kinds of, this would accommodate lots of spirit beings too. Remember how they were vague on exactly those specifics when they were talking about the big amphitheater before? All right, so, you know, we can't just think about it in terms of 300,000 mortal spectators, and that would somehow give us a sense of, like, well, you know, a seat is this big, you know, and so, right? You know, it may have lots and lots of size to it separate from mortal seating, too. So, I think all you can say, you know, it's going to be grand. It's going to be big. And, you know, if you could obliterate something that big, if it wasn't made out of Marantia substance, you're talking about a very high yield phenomenon. Okay. All right. Yeah, I mean, not just, you know, a nuclear bomb, you know, doesn't obliterate, right? You know, it'll rip things up and stuff, but right? I mean, you can go visit, you know, some of the remnants at Nagasaki, say, or something, right? Okay, you know, we're talking about just, you know, nothing left, just gone.
Complete dissolution.
Not even gaseous molecules left, right? Just gone.
Unraveled.
Right, yeah.
So back to the Fermilab thing.
Yeah.
I mean, each super universe is rotating as well as...
Right, it's just right now it's to the north. See, again, all these things...
We rename it every quarter.
That's what I tried to point out. I mean, Norlaishadeck is not called Norlaishadeck on high. That's just for our benefit. They're telling you right now, you know, it's a constellation that's in the northern part of the local universe. But, you know, all that changes with time. All these things are relative. You know, none of these things have any sort of universalness. They're all just for the sake of this book, you know, and for this point in time. I mean, it's not just our local universe headquarters that's the saved kind town. Unfortunately, other local universes don't have a saved kind town. No one's saved there. I mean, see, no, it's purely a relative term. No one calls it Salvington in the universe of universes. It's only for the revelation, you know, just to give you a sense of the truth of it relative to you. You leave it as a spirit being. That's when you're saved, right?
You know. So when you get up there and they ask you where you come from, just tell them the planet of the cross. They're not
going to
know what you're
answering. 606. You can say 606.
That'll stick.
That'll stick. They know 606. You know, Satania is just for our benefit. But the 606, okay.
The numbers.
They know the number.
Michael's world.
You're from planet 606 in this
Michael's
local system.
Should identify.
Yeah, we remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, okay, so let's see. What else, do we have anything else there that we... make sure we didn't miss anything there. We got off on all the obliteration and stuff. On a large world, these departure flares are almost continuous.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, think of the logistics of that. All right, so obviously you're not going to have a huge number for any particular of people for any particular fusion. I mean, you couldn't, you know, the logistics would be impossible, right? Here's a 300,000 for this one. Now, here's a whole new 300,000 for the next one. No, you see, it's obviously not doing something like that. Now, there's a qualification to that we'll see in a little bit here. But you know, for them to be almost continuous, it's got to be on some sort of a manageable scale that, you know, there's an observation of these fusions, right? If it's, you know... But again, you know, we were contemplating something else that was almost continuous. It was kind of mind-boggling in the logistics. You know, launching transport seraphim. Right? They talk about boom, 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 boom. You know, just firing off, and you know, there's all kinds of logistics to each one of those. So they are capable of doing a whole bunch of complicated stuff really, really quickly, really efficiently.
They can't but fuse a bunch at the same time either.
Well, you'll see. You'll see. okay, let's get the last little bit here.
On pre-settled worlds, planets without Mrancha temples, these fusion flashes many times occur in the planetary atmosphere, where the material body of a translation candidate is elevated by the midway creatures and the physical controllers.
Like Elijah was, obviously, right? And I'm sure Enoch was too.
Origins of the chariots of fire.
Right, the quote unquote chariots of fire sort of stuff, you know. Right, so you know they now notice it says these fusion flashes many times occur. I mean, obviously, if there was some very desolate, remote place on the planet. You know, they could take them there rather than, you know, up in the atmosphere. Hey, many times. Obviously, in general, there's not going to be some place like that. So they're going to have to haul them up so that they don't vaporize everyone around them. And then there's all the logistics of, well, you know, how do the midway creature and the physical controllers deal with all this? Like, you know, we've it's like, well, do they take them up and, like, you know, right when they're ready to go, they throw them out the door and then zip away? Or how does this work? You know, I'm not quite sure how this works, but.
Pedal to the.
I mean, you know, maybe the physical controllers can sort of just, you know, levitate them, you know. But. Of course, you take them up high enough, and because they're going to suffocate. I don't know. I mean, there's all these issues.
And why would they need
take a
the
deep breath?
What was that? Why do they need the midway creatures? They don't explain this. There's all these mysteries. I don't know exactly how to think about it. I mean, you know, your first thought is it's the secondary midwayers, and you know they're engaging him materially, and they've got a material craft, and they lift him up.
Oh,
you know, and a material craft.
Just kick him out the back door.
You know, but then Yeah, what do they do when they're, I don't know.
They burn the craft. It's like, you know, the thing where you put somebody on the water on a ship.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it's the Nordic funeral pyre, yes.
Yeah, shoot an arrow.
Oh, it was my favorite ship, you know. So anyway, you can obviously speculate endlessly on the logistics of this precisely, but nonetheless, again, it's the whole point. You got to get them away from immediate surroundings because they would kill everyone around them and you know, whatnot. So, now there is the issue of the impact on the atmosphere. You're thinking, well, maybe they've got to do something even still. You wouldn't want to have incredible shock waves going through the atmosphere either, or, disrupting a large amount of the air on that planet or something. So, there it must be a controlled explosion still. There must be some sort of a shielding that the physical controllers are doing and directing it like into outer space, directing most of the energy out into outer space.
So the midwares lift, the controllers contain.
Yeah.
They're done.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the easiest way to kind of think about it, is the midwares get them up there and then the physical controllers take over and contain it and direct the blast out into space.
Transport Seraphim would have to be very
careful. Now, hopefully, if it happens on this planet, there isn't a communication satellite going overhead at that point or something. Could be grim. What happened to our communication satellite? It was there a second ago.
The ISS used to be right there.
Yeah, the space station used to be there. but I'm sure they'll give us consideration. But who knows? Maybe they wait for some, one of those pieces of space junk that that's floating up there. Target practice.
Yeah.
So that's the initial bit. See, just focused on the temple itself. But the rest of the story, it's like, it's this next section, more about the beings involved. You can see by the title of the next section. Okay, let's get some more here.
Death in translation. Natural physical death is not a mortal inevitability. The majority of advanced evolutionary beings, citizens on worlds existing in the final era of light and life, do not die. They are translated directly from the life in the flesh to the Marantia existence.
Okay, so in the final era of light and life, you start talking about a majority. But as you'll see, there's a whole process. Initially, there's some, and there just gets to be more and more and more. Obviously, the farther you go into light and life, and so here you can see they're definitely just the way they start out the first sentence. They're going to address our fears. Natural physical death is not a mortal inevitability. The whole death and taxes thing. They're addressing that, right? All right. So, and you notice also just how precisely the majority of advanced evolutionary beings, they have all these qualifications, but so everyone, it's not a monolithic populace. There's all kinds of diversity still in the populace. Obviously not as much diversity as we have on this planet right now because of the rebellion and the fault. It's going to be more tightly together than that, but still, there's a spectrum. Okay?
This experience of translation from the material life to the Marantia state, fusion of the immortal soul with the indwelling adjuster, increases in frequency commensurate with the evolutionary progress of the planet. At first, only a few mortals in each age attain translation levels of spiritual progress. But with the onset of the successive ages of the teacher sons, more and more adjuster fusions occur before the termination of the lengthening lives of these progressing mortals. And by the time of the terminal mission of the teacher sons, approximately one quarter of these superb mortals are exempt from natural death.
Okay, so now they're referring to the lengthening lives of these progressing mortals. Remember back when we, we're doing the Planetary Mortal Epics. Right. When they're talking about the post teacher son man in section 7 of paper 52. Yeah, exactly. Remember in there they talk about how it's, getting up to be 500 year life, longevities of those mortals. The innate lifespan, the genetic lifespan. Okay, so can't remember that, I was just giving you that reference. You can go back there and find that for yourself again. But think about that. So this is the first little clue. I've alluded to this a few times about how, even when you get to light and life, there's a lot of collective progress to be made on a planet yet. So here you've got the terminal mission of the teacher's son. So you've got them basically living 500 years in an environment that is so idyllic beyond our imagination, you can't even remotely imagine it. Favorable conditions just everywhere, in every conceivable way, genetically and everything, is transcendently together, and yet approximately one quarter of these superb mortals are exempt from natural death. Just a quarter.
Yeah, that's...
Just a quarter. Right. So it should very humbly remind you of how unlikely it is that you're even a third circler, right?
Good luck.
Right. If just perfect conditions, basically, in 500 years and, a minority are getting to fusion. Okay, Now, the one caveat you can throw in is they may get to be a first circler, but there can be an indefinite length of time to go from first circler to fusion. Okay, so maybe you could argue it's not as grim as it appears. Maybe you do have a very large fraction that are getting the first circler, but that last step, remember we talked about it, everyone's leaving Gerasim basically as a first circler, but some of them aren't fusing until they get to Salvington.
Yeah.
Right. So that last bit of synchronizing and getting from first circler to fusion, it isn't always as short a length of time as it was for Jesus. Right? It's just a few months for Jesus.
Yeah.
Right? Right? From Mount Hermon to the baptism, right? But nonetheless, in general, one should, be very hesitant to think that, you can just learn how to skip properly and boom, you're going to be a first circler. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump, right? And you're a first circler. Doesn't appear so. 500-year lifespan in a very idyllic nature-nurture context is... pretty transcendent of where any of us are, right? Yeah. Okay, so there's the first one. You'll see they throw in other things like that, in this paper too, that bring in some humility about your circle progress. Let's see, what else do we have there? We've kind of already talked about, I guess that's it. We kind of already talked about all that already. Yeah, so okay, let's keep going.
Farther along in the era of light and life, the midway creatures or their associates sense the approaching status of probable soul adjuster union and signify this to the destiny guardians, who in turn communicate these matters to the finaliter group under whose jurisdiction this mortal may be functioning. Then there is issued the summons of the planetary sovereign for such a mortal to resign all planetary duties, bid farewell to the world of his origin, and repair to the inner temple of the planetary sovereign, there to await Morantia transit, the translation flash from the material domain of evolution to the Morantia level of pre-spirit progression.
Okay. You know, notice you had the summons of the planetary sovereign, the inner temple of the planetary sovereign. You know, we didn't emphasize that, you know, but it's in the previous section, in that first sentence, the presence of a Morantia temple at the capital. Right, okay, you know, this Morantia temple is at the planetary capital, where the planetary prince and his staff are. Okay, so a planetary sovereign now. you know, just got those basic details that, you know, there's, you know, they're aware when, everyone's aware when it's getting close, and everyone makes some preparations, and, but notice in that very first sentence, farther along in the era of light and life, the midway creatures or their associates.
Yeah, what's that?
Right. Like we've pointed out a number of times, they're not allowed to talk about the lesser order of angels. Right, the ones that are like midwayers, only they're not origin, you know, out of the whole like the midway creatures are. They're, you know, out of the Trinity. They're you know, from the infinite spirit. They're the most downstepped expression of the children of the infinite spirit, down parallel to basically the same level as the secondary midwayers. Right, so they can do material things. That if those material things need to be done. Yep.
Why is it the midwares that have to clue in the guardian angels of the impending event? I mean, what can they sense that the guardian angel cannot?
These midwares and these lesser angels, see, have a very, very like mind. You know, like energy, intimacy with us. You know, it's why rebel midwares could, you know, take control of things, you know, possess people. So it's that, you know, see, they don't say that, but that's between the lines. See, obviously that intimacy, that similarity is required to
sense.
You know, they can sense when the mind energy of that individual, you know, is, as there must be some certain motion that gets going in, and it's like, oh, that's the pre-fusion motion.
Yeah, over to the temple. Quick.
There must be some particular, you know, aspect to the energy system that they, you know, they pick up on.
Chris?
Yep.
And now, when they talk about the flash, is this the same? Is this the same thing that's going on in the prior section?
Yes.
Right, we're talking about blast.
We're talking about the fusion flash. Yes. Right. It all sounds so benign. The translation flash.
Yeah.
Like a flash in the pan. No, not a flash in the pan.
Really big pan.
Yeah. Right, I mean, they're using the word flash just because it's an instantaneous, sort of event. It's just, two. It's not some long, you know. No, it's just boom. all right. Let's see. Anything else there? Notice, like we've commented so many times, there is a a bureaucracy, if you have to use that word, you know, to everything, right? I mean, there is a precise order, you know, to how, you know, documents have to be recorded, you know, certain individuals have to be informed, you know, whatnot, that all, everything that happens on high, you know, has all of this administrative logistics to it.
They slipped something else in there too.
Uh-huh.
Working under the jurisdiction of a finality.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I was just going to bring that up. Right. And you know, just to remind you, see here, you see how definitively the finaliters are overseeing what's going on. Right. The finaliters are very much entering into the administrative affairs. Because the point of what's going on now is you're orienting what's going on the planet towards the grand universe settled in light and life. It's not such a localized phenomenon anymore. And no one but the finaliters, you know, and a few others, have any sense of such issues. You know, for everyone else, even a planetary sovereign, it's way beyond his pay grade. I mean, he's clueless about how this all fits into the, you know, the future. He's just, he knows how to properly do his job in the moment, you know, in that localized setting. But, you know, the finaliters, and similar beings' job to have the really big picture, you know, in mind, and can direct those below them. It's like, you do this. Why? Well, just because. you'll see in a few hundred trillion years, you know, why I'm ordering you to do that. Right. You know, again, remember, you've taken that oath to the Paradise Trinity. Right. You know, you are now an agent of the whole. Right. You have the big picture. You know, in ways that most beings don't have. You know, even very high beings don't have that kind of objectivity. That, you know, you go out there and minister. All right. Okay. Yep. Keep going here.
When the family, friends, and working group of such a fusion candidate have foregathered in the Morontia Temple, they are distributed around the central stage whereon the fusion candidates are resting, meantime freely conversing with their assembled friends. A circle of intervening celestial personalities is arranged to protect the material mortals from the action of the energies manifest at the instant of the life flash, which delivers the ascension candidate from the bonds of material flesh, thereby doing for such an evolutionary mortal everything that natural death does for those who thereby delivered from the flesh.
Or who are thereby delivered from the flesh, yeah. Okay, so let's deal with the obvious thing first. Right, so the temple doesn't get obliterated because it's made out of Morontia material. None of the spectators get obliterated because you have a creature shield, right? And they never tell you who these beings are. Right? These are unrevealed beings, some kind of really cool shielding beings.
Definitely.
Right? That just put themselves around it. You know, so you can literally visualize that. I mean, you know, they're going to make a cannon barrel here, yeah. Right? And the blast is going to be directed upward. And then probably the master physical controllers are involved in the further channeling of this all the way to space or something, right? So it doesn't mess up the atmosphere. Right? So it's a, it's all this logistics, you know, and again, I mean, you know, every single spectator would be completely obliterated if you didn't have this shield of beings. You know, and so, you know, you've got this, like, well, you know, what kind of a being? They obviously must be quite transcendent relative to us, and yet these very material energies that are being released are very much interacting with them, and you know they're channeling it upwards. Right? It's not like it's not like a circle of solitary messengers, because the energy would just go right through them and vaporize everyone. Right?
Striking
them. Right? This is some sort of a being that can very much interact with these physical energies, and yet, you know, you I'm sure can't interact with them. Now, how much they block the view, I don't know. Can you somehow still observe in, but the energies can't get out? I don't know. And you can speculate.
I have to wear special glasses.
3D glasses. Anyway, it's important to note these two things, right? The statement about this protecting spectators and the statement about protecting the temple. As you put the two together, it's obviously a very high energy event. But you also notice, it's just, you've got this little intimate group of people that are just down there in the center of this temple. They're not up in the stands or anything like that. They're just standing around the stage. Yeah. See, so it's a very intimate little gathering. Let's see here. But it's happening in this temple, obviously it doesn't have a dirt floor. It's got a Marantia floor.
Yeah.
See? Right? Otherwise the blast would go down into the earth, and vaporize underneath the temple, right.
New cavern.
Okay. So these quote unquote celestial personalities, yes.
In the former section, not long since I sojourned in the world far north,
uh-huh.
around 25 Marantia shrines were functioning. They were talking about temples like that.
Well, see, you notice how they say Marantia shrines, and so
yeah.
Rather than Marantia temples. So they're probably just for the fusion events, okay. A much smaller affair. That's just for the fusion events. It's not for all these other things that the Marantia temple is used for. Now, again, remember, the Marantia temple is used for a whole bunch of things besides, these fusion events. That's the only thing we ever remember because we're so fixated on ourselves and all this. But there's all this other stuff that happens in those Marantia temples besides us fusing potentially. Now, the fun thing in there is, arranged to protect the material mortals from the action of the energies manifest at the instant of the quote-unquote life flash. Why is it a quote-unquote life flash? Okay. They kind of give you clues, they go on. Thereby doing for such an evolutionary mortal everything that natural death does. Now literally it's a death flash. In an instant, you're dead, right? Right. You're dying, right? I mean, technically, you're still dying. It's not like, your mortal self doesn't die. It dies in an instant in this incredible high energy event. Where you have, one moment you're totally functioning, and the next moment you're not.
It's like being on the gallows.
Right. It's instantaneously you die.
You can dangle for a while.
Right.
Doing the same thing.
Right. But, figuratively, we can talk about it being a life flash. You're moving on in a flash, you're moving on to your next life. Right. But, they put it in quotes there, so it gets you to reflect on it. Okay, technically, literally, it's a death flash. Right.
Another real quick question.
Right. I mean, and who's responsible for that death?
The adjuster.
Fragment of the Father. Does the Father kill you? Yes. Doesn't murder you, but he kills you. Right, he kills us all. I mean, your mortality is the design of the Father, right?
I guess it's kind of immaterial at that point, whether it's
Yeah, really not.
Pardon the pun, it's immaterial.
Ouch.
Yes, in an instant you are immaterial. So much for that boat anchor you've been frustrated with. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I mean, notice the title of the section is not merely translation. Right? Your mortal self is not translated anywhere. Your mortal self is mortal. It dies. It's got to die one way or another. Either goes out with a bang or a whimper.
After the flash.
Uh-huh.
Do you need a service? Oh,
no,
how do you get onto the mansion worlds?
Yeah, that's coming up.
Okay.
They're gonna explain that in a second. Okay.
I need to know these things.
All right.
I was just wondering why you're so curious.
Okay, so, there's no delivery from the bonds of material flesh that's a benign event, right? No, it's death. And
you're falling asleep and going and dying in your sleep.
Yeah,
benign than this.
Yes, more benign than this. Yes, this is the opposite of benign. This is as grand as your death can get. Let's see. Okay, so, all right. So you are quote unquote delivered from the flesh. Okay, now what?
Many fusion candidates may be assembled in the spacious temple at the same time. And what a beautiful occasion when mortals thus foregather to witness the ascension of their loved ones in spiritual flames. And what a contrast to those earlier ages when mortals must commit their dead to the embrace of terrestrial elements. The scenes of weeping and wailing, characteristic of earlier epochs of human evolution, are now replaced by ecstatic joy and the sublimest enthusiasm as these God-knowing mortals bid their loved ones a transient farewell, and they are removed from their material associations by the spiritual fires of consuming grandeur and ascending glory. On worlds settled in life, light and life, funerals are occasions of supreme joy, profound satisfaction, and inexpressible hope.
Okay, so you notice in the previous paragraph they said fusion candidates, and so here they're being more explicit. You know, they definitely do this. So that bit about almost continuous, it's not a pure linear thing again. See, they've got a parallel phenomenon going here.
Stack them up.
So boom, 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 they're going off inside the temple. Now, you notice that, they have, quote-unquote funerals. Remember, again, I mean, like they said up above, one quarter, right, you still have a lot of people that are just, dying of old age. But they are pointing out that whether or not they're going up in a blaze of glory or dying of old age, as we understand, the whole weeping and wailing thing, and is a thing of the past.
500 years.
I mean, just think about how different you'd think about a regular old material death, when you've got the fusion thing going on the planet as well. I mean, it really contextualizes death in general, and allows everyone to get much more objective about it. No one is thinking of it as the end of anything. It's the first definitive beginning. Finally, you can kind of get on with manifesting your personality without the limitations of a material body. All right. Okay, so you got, I don't think I need, they try to give you some poetry there and stuff, right? To encourage this sort of fearless approach to death. But, it's an interesting kind of double-edged poetry. spiritual fires of consuming grandeur and ascending glory.
Far is far.
All right, why don't we get some more here?
The souls of these progressing mortals are increasingly filled with faith, hope, and assurance. The spirit permeating those gathered around the translation shrine resembles that of the joyful friends and relatives who might assemble at a graduating exercise for one of their group, or who might come together to witness the conferring of some great honor upon one of their number. And it would be decidedly helpful if less advanced mortals could only learn to view natural death with something of this same cheerfulness and lightheartedness.
In case it isn't obvious, you're one of those less advanced mortals. So am I. We are.
I've got to be a third circler.
Yeah. Again, I mean, you know, it's all pretty straightforward. But just notice, like I said, see what they're doing. Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're giving us facts about light and life and fusion and whatnot. But you know, more immediately, they're trying to get us to recognize not the facts of then, but the truth of then, and hence the truth of now.
Of course.
Right. Try to get us to think about death more objectively. Right? It's just, it's very primitive and foolish to be so distraught about death. So, and so anxious about death.
It's a liberation.
Right? And yeah, that's, I know that's not easy. It's easier said than done. But, you know, they're definitely trying to encourage us to take on that challenge. I mean, if Jesus wants us to fear not as step one, right, where do you start? You know, if you can get over the fear of death, you can probably get rid of the rest of the fears. You know, it starts with the stuff that's, you know, within the circle of your end of your nose, and you move outward. You know, start with that fear.
Still have that self-preservation
of those fears. Right. Again, you're not eliminating the fear. What are you doing with the fear? You're not somehow erasing it. You're mastering it. Right? You're taking a hold of it, and you are the master of it rather than it the master of you. Those energies that you currently call fear can be changed, and you know, they're the same basic energy, but in your master hands, they're focus. Right? They're the energy of focus in your mind. You know, and the more you can focus your mind, the more you can use the cosmic intuitions. Those require focus. None of them work in some fuzzed out unity consciousness thing. You've got to bring your mind to a focus to use the three cosmic intuitions. So you need to overcome your fear to get at the intuitions more. Right? And the first one is called logical acumen. Acumen part means bringing to a point, literally. Right? That sounds focused to me. Right. So, it's very important. You're not going to make any progress with the cosmic intuitions if you're still fraught with fear. Or if you're constantly fuzzing your mind out by favoring your unity consciousness. Right? Okay.
Mortal observers can see nothing of their translated associates subsequent to the fusion flash. Such translated souls proceed by a gesture transit direct to the resurrection hall of the appropriate Marantia training world. These transactions concerned with the translation of living human beings to the Marantia world are supervised by an archangel who was assigned to such a world on the day when it was first settled in light and life.
Now, see, mortal observers can see nothing of their translated associates subsequent. Seems to indicate that you can still see them right up to the point of the flash, see, even though they're surrounded by this shield.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, a valid assumption. And then, yes, you may remember just your Marantia brain fused to the adjuster is not a hopeless boat anchor. It can translate that soul by itself. No transport seraphim needed. Right? It just goes to wherever you're going to be, whatever resurrection hall you're going to be resurrected in. Might be the first mansion world. It might be Salvington. Right? Whatever it is.
Is this the only time that adjuster transit is mentioned in
the book? I think there's a reference to this basic idea maybe a couple other times. You know,
but the same event.
This same issue of if you fuse, the adjuster takes you directly.
Still mysterious.
Yeah, right. It is definitely mysterious. But it makes sense, see, that the adjuster could do this itself. Because remember, that soul was made by the adjuster. It's this very mysterious thing that didn't require Rancha Power Supervisors. See, so it's something that's not boat anchor-like, like your actual Marancha body will be. It has to be transported by a transport seraphim. But that soul itself it's enough like the adjuster that it just can hitch a ride with it. Yeah. Yeah.
But even in these days, I mean, when we die, the body stays, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and the soul, the adjuster...
Well, no, the adjuster goes by itself.
Exactly.
Right. The your guardian angels take care of your soul.
Okay, so all that processes.
Yeah, right, and they have to be transported. Yeah. Okay.
By the time a world attains the fourth stage of light and life, more than half the mortals leave the planet by translation from among the living. Such diminishment of death continues on and on, but I know of no system whose inhabited worlds, even though long settled in life, are entirely free from natural death as the technique of escape from the bonds of flesh. And until such a high state of planetary evolution is uniformly attained, the Marancha training worlds of the local universe must continue to service as educational and cultural spheres for evolving Marancha progressors. The elimination of death is theoretically possible, but it has not yet occurred according to my observation. Perhaps such a status may be attained during the faraway stretches of the succeeding epochs of seventh stage of settled planetary life.
Okay, so...
There's accidents even when they're young. I mean, they have to have natural death if they die.
Right, yeah. They actually mentioned that, you know, a little bit later on about, yeah, I mean, you still have accidental death and all that sort of stuff, right? I mean, you still could have, you know, a child die and needs to be resurrected in a probationary nursery. It doesn't matter how far settled in light and life, you know, a world is. Remember, that's why they have those probationary nurseries up the scale, not just for the mansion worlds, but you got to have them all the way up the ladder. Again, notice you get all the way to fourth stage. Okay, now you got more than half, but still, yeah, you just broke 50%. Okay, so you know, and even then, like they point out, I mean, again, the supreme, you know, requires there to be mortals, even when you're way, way, way settled in life, it requires some mortals to still be dying a natural death of old age. You can't build the supreme without all of this sort of non-linear sort of stuff, see, going on. So just notice that's the general theme and all these things they keep telling you. It's very rare that you're going to have something, okay, that's totally done with, you can burn the bridges behind us now. I mean, most things have a long, long tail that trickles on and on and on, okay?
It's called evolution.
Yeah. Eventually you're going to have a local system where none of the inhabitants need mansion worlds, because they're all jumping to higher levels, okay, and they can change the mansion worlds to, you know, be used for something else. So there you are, kind of leaving something behind. But in general, you know, things are kind of spread out from beginning to end of the finite. You know, it isn't just a linear thing that chugs along. Okay? You have the end from the beginning and the beginning from the end, maybe a way to think about it.
The translated souls of the flowering ages of the settled spheres do not pass through the mansion worlds. Neither do they sojourn as students on the Morantia worlds of the system or constellation. They do not pass through any of the earlier phases of Morantia life. They are the only ascending mortals who so nearly escape the Morantia transition from material existence to semi-spirit status. The initial experience of such sun-seized mortals in the ascension career is in the services of the progression worlds of the universe headquarters. And from these study worlds of Salvington, they go back as teachers to the very worlds they passed by, subsequently going on inward to paradise by the established route of mortal ascension.
Yes, yeah, I already referred to that. And if you want to look back at some of those details, remember we talked about quote-unquote sun-seized mortals. That's right at the end of paper 49. You know, you're in what, section 6 on terrestrial escape. They have that final subsection 5 about mortals of the primary modified order of ascension. And that's what we're talking about here. So as you're getting into, you know, into light and life, you start having some of those mortals, you know, in increasing numbers, that skip all the way up to the local universe headquarters in terms of their immediate destination. But like they point out, you got to come back down as a teacher, both for your sake and for others. And the more, you know, just think about it, the more that you people that you have that are jumping way up and coming back, those that are ascending are getting an educational influence that, you know, you couldn't have gotten before that. You know, and it's so some ascenders, see, come out of their ascension with that experience that they were taught by those that were coming back a lot. Others, you know, kind of had to maybe working up without a lot of people coming back from high levels and teaching like that, and everything in between. So the whole point is just to have all the different variations as you can imagine. Ascenders being educated in all kinds of different ways in order to flesh out all the possibilities of the finite. Okay.
Could you but visit a planet in an advanced stage of development, you would quickly grasp the reasons for providing for the differential reception of ascending mortals on the mansion and higher Morantia worlds. You would readily understand that beings passing on from such highly evolved spheres are prepared to resume their paradise ascent far in advance of the average mortal arriving from a disordered and backward world like Urantia.
It would be immediately apparent, oh, I am a blob of protoplasm. Slightly better than pond scum. I get it. Right, that's what they're referring to. You know, like we said, you can't even imagine what these worlds are like. So, yeah, it's like, yeah, he could probably go a couple classes ahead of me. Just stressing that.
Keep an eye on him.
So, but it's important to have disordered and backward worlds because certain elements of supremacy can't be made any other way. Just remind it again.
Yeah. Well, we got it.
No matter from what level of planetary attainment human beings may ascend to the Morantia worlds, the seven mansion spheres afford them ample opportunity to gain in experience as teacher students all of everything which they failed to pass through because of the advanced status of their native planets.
It's just reminding you of that issue. Yeah, it's all groovy that you're born and raised on this very advanced planet, but there's some things that you're missing that you're going to have to make up for. And the only way to do it is to, have some access to some lesser phenomena, right? So you're missing some of the differentials that are, indispensable, right? Those inevitabilities, right? You can't get some of these differentials on a very advanced world, so you've got to go in search of those differentials. You've got to experience certain differentials. And they're just reminding you of that.
The universe is unfailing in the application of these equalizing techniques designed to ensure that no ascender shall be deprived of aught which is essential to his ascension experience.
Just like I was just stressing there, see that? We have this tendency to think that, if only we weren't so disordered and backward,
we'd be so much better off.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, but remember, I mean, there's aspects of this that are just indispensable in supremacy. There's all kinds of beings that come here as visitors, because if they don't, they cannot complete themselves as ascension candidates.
Nor can they imagine.
I mean, there's all those issues, right? They can't imagine the differential. It's like we can't imagine the differential, but then just the big picture. I mean, again, if you can't make supremacy without every possible finite, differential being experientialized.
Yeah.
Again, this is that wholeness, picture, that non-linear thing that is, we're just so used to not thinking that way, and gives us lots of erroneous conclusions about our lives, about what's bad and what's good, right? I mean, how bad is this place when it's indispensable to supremacy? Wouldn't that by definition make it good? Right? So we've got to think more objectively about these issues.
We can't get anywhere else.
Right.
And
right.
Everybody knows it.
And you only get one shot at this life. Don't pass pass by the potentials that this life on a disordered and backward world provides. Yeah. You'll never get another chance like this again to actualize these kind of potentials. All right, well then we'll, we've got the classic golden age, quote-unquote, thing we'll talk about next time. Now that we've dealt with that issue of what about me and my death, now we can start to talk a little bit more objectively about light and life in general. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.